Hi there, I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane. If y'all are looking for a little American magic,
then put away your athames and wands and dig out your box of roots, stones, and bones.
This is New World Witchery.
Tonight we'll be visiting the crossroads with fellow podcasters and witches Chris Orapello and Tara McGuire. They'll be sharing their particular brand of witchy practice, which is rooted in a very localized set of figures from New Jersey folklore. Stay tuned. Welcome, New World Witchery listeners. First of all, a big thanks to our guests, Chris and Tara. Since they're going to be the primary focus of tonight, I'm not going to say too much about them here, other than that you can find out more at Chris's website, which is infinite-beyond.com. We'll have a couple of songs sort of framing the interview as well, stealing that idea from Chris. If you've ever listened to his Down at the Crossroads podcast, you know he sort of intersperses the interviews he does with a really great selection of music. So I'm sort of cribbing from him and putting a song right before the interview, a song right after the interview. Being a little lazier than he is, he likes to intersperse the music, and he has really good, you know, sense of like where to cut and put in music and things like that. I'm going to be lazy and say, here's an intro song, whole interview, outro song, and that's kind of how I do it. The first song you're going to hear is from Tuatha De, and it's a song called Tonight, and it's from their album Kith and Kin. I hope you enjoy this interview. I really enjoyed getting to talk to Chris. It was actually the second time in a month or so that it's actually like the third or fourth time within a month that I've talked to Chris. He had me on his show, down at the Crossroads during December. So if you haven't heard that, basically I talk a little bit about, my path to witchcraft, kind of what witchcraft looks like to me. Kind of its goals and its meanings and things like that. And then also a good bit about, Krampus, who is a figure that I do a good bit of, or not, he's not a figure I do a good bit of research on, but there are festivals about him that I do research on. So, I talk a little bit about him and, the sort of Krampus festivals in the United States, on Chris's show, which was in December of 2015. You can find that interview. And so I got to talk to him for that. I got to talk to he and Tara for that. And then, they also were at the Krampuslauf that, go to and that I observe and participate in Philadelphia. So I got to see them there. And then we get to talk, here on this interview, which was fantastic as well. It's so much fun. Chris is really, really, thoughtful and knowledgeable. He's got a depth of knowledge about the occult, that goes, far and wide, from everything from ceremonial magic and Wicca to Freemasonry, and then, traditional witchcraft and some other sort of incarnations, chaos magic, things like that, magic in just various contexts, which is really cool, I think anyway. And then Tara has a good sort of rootsy, approach to her work as well. So I think that's a neat compliment to the interview. So I think you'll enjoy it. I think it's a lot of fun. I won't go on any longer about it. I hope you enjoy it. Very insightful in the ways that folklore can build up a magical and spiritual practice and how important those folk influences can, and I would say maybe should, be on witchcraft. So anyway, on with the music and with the interview.
In the moonlight,
All right, we have with us tonight on New World Witchery two guests that I am very excited to talk to, not because it's my first time talking to them. Heavens no. In fact, I've talked to them several times now, and it is always a treat and a delight. We have dragged kicking and screaming away from his midnight pacts and deals for musical fame down at the crossroads, the magnificent Chris Orapello, who is joining us from his podcast and his sort of broader role in the witchy world. And his, for lack of a better term, I'm calling her majestic consort, Tara McGuire. So welcome to New World Witchery, Chris and Tara.
Thank you very much, Corey. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi, Corey.
I'm delighted to have both of you here. So there's a couple of reasons I you know, excited to have you guys on here. Probably the biggest one is one we'll get to eventually, just because it's a subject that's really near and dear to my heart because it involves folklore. But I kind of would like you, if you don't mind, to give me a little bit of your backstory when it comes to magic and witchcraft. Like, how did you, so let's start, I guess, with what do you identify yourself as now, and how has that changed and evolved over the years? And that's a question for both of you, so either one of you can jump in and answer.
You want to start?
I'll start.
You start.
Right now, I think the closest term that I can personally identify with is witch. And the only reason I say that is because for some reason it doesn't, I don't feel entirely comfortable with it, even though that's the best way to describe me. So I don't know about that. But I think I don't know if I was always a witch necessarily. I mean, I identify more as a pagan, as a Wiccan at one point. Mm-hmm. Personally, I had a identified with the philosophy of Thelema, you know, do what thou wilt, more so than the rest of the religion, which, you know, deals with holidays and the Gnostic mass and such, you know. But I identify it as a Thelemite philosophically, because I really, you know, I liked the law. It made a lot of sense to me for a time being. But when I was – how did I get on this path? Well, as a kid, I think I was like 2 or 3 years old, and I saw a ghost.
Hmm.
And I saw it consistently for 3 nights. And even as a child, I thought it was the ghost of my grandfather checking in on me, because in retrospect, I believe that he had recently passed away at that time. So because of this, I really got bit by the paranormal bug.
Mm-hmm.
So I was all about anything that dealt with ghosts and the paranormal, you know, books and shows and what have you, the occult.
Time Life.
Yeah, like the Time Life book series, Mysteries of the Unknown, love them. as a child, I bought a book, How to Find a Ghost. It was like one of those little kids' books, but it was actually a good book. It had some decent information in it for the time being. I still have it.
And that's why I'm laughing. I've seen it. It's hilarious.
And it wasn't until I got to be about, like, you know, 14, 15, and I came across the metaphysical section in the bookstore and learned that magic was real. That it wasn't just for stories and movies, that there was actually a place for it in the world, and that it existed, and some people actually still practiced it. You know, I came across the first book I purchased was Earth, Air, Fire, and Water by Scott Cunningham, which is just a book of spells. Mm-hmm. And that, in retrospect, that was probably the best book I could have found, because it was free of all the dogma and the structure and all the tools that you'll find with Wicca. So I got introduced to magic and witchcraft in a completely neutral context. And I did some spells from that book, and I got some results, and I got what I needed from it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I stopped working with it for several years until I saw the movie The Craft, you know, that came out. And I bring that up because it's true, but it's still kind of embarrassing that was the movie that kind of – it brought me back around to that path. And it made me really reconsider, you know, witchcraft and even Wicca at the time, because that was the most common thing you would come across when you would look for books on magic. You know, this was long before the independent publishing boom that we're in the middle of now. So it was just Llewellyn and Wiser for the most part at the bookstores. So, you know, it was all Wicca all the time, some Crowley, but mostly Wicca. So, So for years I identified, you know, as Wiccan, but I also read up on, you know, ceremonial magic and some of Crowley's stuff and, you know, Enochian magic, anything that kind of caught my eye, I would look into. You know, I even had a copy of The Book of Black Magic by Arthur Edward Waite, which has, you know, talks about, you know, quote unquote black magic. And I hate using that term, but that's what the book's called. And it talked about the grimoires and just that whole aspect of occultism, you know, the darker aspects of occultism. I mean, being a fan of heavy metal music and horror movies, you know, I had to look into other things, you know. So I had a copy of the Satanic Bible by Anton LaVey. I still have a copy of the Satanic Bible by Anton LaVey, but I don't do anything with it. It's just, I have it. It's there, you know.
It's a fun conversation piece.
Yeah.
He has copies of a lot of questionable stuff.
You know, I read up on some of the Golden Dawn, you know, stuff that was released by Rigardi. What else? You know, got involved in a couple of organizations here and there, but none of it really panned out, except for the one organization that I did get involved with in 2004, which was Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2004, I became a Mason because I knew some Masons, and I always knew that Masonry, even though it in itself wasn't a cult, you know, wasn't an occult thing, it was a fraternity. It was different, but I knew it had a heavy influence on the Golden Dawn and even, systems like Wicca, for example, are very heavily influenced by Freemasonry. Mm-hmm. So since I had an opportunity to join, I was interested in it, but I also was curious as to get an insider's perspective on Western esotericism by becoming a Freemason. But as it turns out, I really enjoyed the teachings of the fraternity, and I was even an officer for several years, but I never became worshipful master of my lodge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, inner politics always make things turn sour, and I ended up leaving, and I haven't really been back since, and that's not out of protest. It's just that my schedule really doesn't allow to attend. It doesn't really allow for me to attend meetings.
Yeah. So it's not something where you have a problem with, you know, the actual organization or what it does and anything like that. It's much more of a, you know, it's, we get busy, yeah. We have busy lives.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm still a dues paying Mason. I still have my members card and everything. So,
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because, like, you, a lot of the people that you're mentioning, you know, you've got Waite, you've got Crowley, you've got, you know, a lot of the sort of Western esotericism that you're talking about, so much of that gets filtered through England and the sort of the British Isles.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come, you know, through Masonry, and Masonry obviously has a lot of European connections, but also has a very strong presence in the United States for a long time. So I just think I think it's interesting because I think that seems – if I think about kind of your trajectory, and I may be reading into it, but I feel like that's maybe sort of a stepping stone in that process of moving from Europe to America. Am I way off base on that?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I follow what you're saying.
Okay. Well, we can come, actually, let's come back around to that, because I do kind of want to talk a little bit about Masonry a little bit as well. But Tara, what about your path? What is your sort of route to witchcraft been?
Well, I was kind of raised by wolves. I grew up in South Jersey, in a broken family, single mother, and I had two older brothers who were a lot more in need of attention than I was, so I was kind of allowed to run amok. And we lived in and around the Pine Barrens, so my running amok was always out in the woods. I hesitate to make the statement that I have always been a witch, because that sounds kind of corny to me a little bit. It just seems like a little elitist to me, but from a very young age, I was always, like constructing my own little rituals out in the woods that I would like make up. And I was also, I was very much a solitary child as well, because we moved around a lot. So I didn't have any friends other than go out into the woods and hang out with trees and look at plants and catch animals that I probably shouldn't have been putting my hands on and getting filthy dirty. And I was heavily into reading about mythology. So I was reading all these different pantheons and the old folk tales and the fairy tales and things like that. And it all kind of just boiled into this thing that around the age of 12, I actually figured out was witchcraft. So I frequently will describe myself even now as like a swamp witch, because it's still very much like dirty magic for me. I was never into the ritualized aspects of things. I still have problems with that. I didn't get into a whole hell of a lot of Western esoterica type of stuff like Chris did. I didn't read Crowley until a fairly late age, actually. And for a while I got into chaos magic shortly after Chris and I met. I was going through a lot of things in my life at the time and trying to figure out what I was doing and who I was and, you know, the freak out of your 20s and started running with chaos magic. And I had set up a little altar to the ancestors and had been working with stuff like that, kind of in like a Day of the Dead fashion. But then it started leading me more and more towards voodoo, Haitian voodoo specifically. And I started getting in very deep with Papa Gede and just the nation of Gede and Baron Samedi and all of that. And I got pretty deep into voodoo for probably about 12 years. That was like my primary practice. I was still a witch, and I still would do like weird little witchcrafty things, but I started getting into root work at that point too, and that kind of meshes so well together with witchcraft. So it just became like one thing. And voodoo, just in case you don't know, is a whole lot of responsibility and a lot of work. And that's not me at all. So as time went on, I got kind of frustrated with continuing to practice it. And also I was getting older and becoming more aware of the world and self-aware and just of justice and injustice. And I started feeling a little icky about practicing a religion that was based in an extremely poor, oppressed country, and yet having no inclination of ever visiting that country. Like, I never wanted to be in voodoo. I wasn't part of a house. I didn't want to become a mambo. I was never going to go to Haiti. So it started to feel a little icky to me that I was continuing to practice the religion. Like, I felt like I didn't have a right to do that. And I started moving away from it. And at that time, Chris was also moving away from Wicca and getting more into traditional witchcraft. And we kind of like backed into each other with both of those things, because we've been together for 14 years, but we've never practiced together. So now it's just, I've come to terms with a lot of things with my practice. I don't need a pantheon of gods to follow. And I always had issues with that, like trying to label myself as something and feeling like I needed to have a label. But I've come, you know, come around. I don't need that. So now I'm just a witch. I mean, I'm an animist, if you want to put like deeper labels on things. But I'm just a witch. Like, I don't have a particular religious pathway anymore. And it's awkward, but I'm getting used to it and it feels okay. So I think that I finally figured out what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, it sounds a little like maybe you sort of started as a swamp witch and took a very circuitous path to become eventually a swamp witch.
Yeah.
But I mean, it sounds like it really worked. And, you know, it's interesting because it's almost like you and Chris were in an interfaith relationship for those 14 years, and that your two different faiths just both happened to have a lot of magic in them.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's very interesting. And so, I mean, obviously, Terry, your practice, you know, has always had a lot of sort of new world leanings, because you've got, as you said, you've got basically running around the Pine Barrens, and you're kind of doing a lot of the sort of backwoods sort of magic and folk magic.
Yeah.
And then you've also got the, you know, Haiti is, you know, it's a new world location as well. And mm-hmm. so it generates that religion. And Chris, I think, so when what I was kind of trying to get to earlier was a lot of like that ceremonial magic seems to come out of Western Europe, particularly in the late 19th, early 20th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think it's interesting that you, because now I think your practice has become a lot more centered on your particular location in a new world environment, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Correct.
Right. And I think that's really interesting. And, you know, at first I was saying, like, oh, well, maybe that's the Freemasonry, because Freemasonry was really, really important to sort of early American, I don't want to make it sound like, you know, Freemasons ran the country or anything like that. There were a lot of people who were into Freemasonry who were also, you know, members of the first sets of governments that the United States had. So.
That's a different podcast that involves a tinfoil hat.
Yes, and I don't want to go down that road. That's not what I'm trying to get into. But just saying, like, there were a lot of people who were very, you know, involved with Freemasonry, particularly. You know, in sort of colonial America. And so I just thought, oh, well, that's interesting. Maybe that's kind of how he got into the sort of localized thing. But now I'm kind of like, no, it was Tara. Long enough exposure to a swamp witch.
Yeah. You know?
Well, I don't know if I would even say that entirely.
No.
Only because... See, I've been involved in so many different things. I mean, I've been on my path for over 20 years. So every time I have to talk about myself, I never know where to start, never know where to go with it. But like a part of my path involved being a member of a Gardnerian coven for about, well, I was an initiated member for 6 months, but I was practicing with them for, you know, 6 months outer court, 6 months inner court kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And through that coven, I had to research Hearn the Hunter, you know, a horned deity. I had to research him. And when I learned about Hearn the Hunter, you know, I found out that he haunts a forest. He's a ghost. He's a spirit that haunts a forest in Windsor in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, this ghost that haunts a forest in the UK, is now a deity? Like, people are working with him in a witchcraft context, in a coven context. So I instantly thought of the Jersey Devil, you know, mm-hmm. like, well, okay, this is a spirit that haunts the local forest here in South Jersey. Why the hell isn't anyone worshiping him? Why isn't anyone working with him? Like, that could easily work as a ritual element, you know, in a tradition. So I think that was kind of, at least me, started to shift my thinking towards creating or working with more locally. So.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's such an interesting way, like, to sort of intuit this, because I mean, you really, like, it almost started with you, like, looking at an archetype and saying, like, okay, horned figure, it's Hearn the Hunter, you know, this localized spirit that gets elevated. And then I really love that you kind of turn that reflection on your own environment and said, well, wait a second. I don't have to, you know, be involved with this deity that's, you know, thousands of miles away from me. Yeah. I've got something in my backyard that works just as well. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about, if you can, whatever you care to share, I'd love to hear about what you guys are doing in terms of working with the Jersey Devil. We probably should start with, who is the Jersey Devil? What is the Jersey Devil?
Who is the Jersey Devil? Should I do this one?
You want to take that one?
I'll take this
one. Okay.
Okay. Pretty much every kid in South Jersey knows this story. Well, I'm beginning to learn it's weaseling out a little bit over the years, like the younger kids don't know it as well.
It's not a hockey team.
Well, it is a hockey team.
Not just a hockey team.
It is the Jersey Devil story centers around a particular family in South Jersey. It's the Leeds family. Mm-hmm. They had immigrated here in I don't remember what year it was, but I believe it was from England. And there's a woman in the family who some people have traced it to a woman named Deborah Smith, who immigrated here for marriage. And she married into the Leeds family. that part isn't concrete. That's just like what some of the scholars and people have like theorized about. But it was said that Mrs. Leeds, Mother Leeds, as you'll hear her be called quite often, had 12 children. And she found out that she was pregnant for the 13th time and wasn't very happy about this.
She was tired.
Homegirl was tired. And it was supposed to be in like the 1700s, like 1735 is usually the year that gets quoted a lot. And Mother Leeds was in labor. And of course, it was a stormy night. Mm-hmm. And there had been many rumors flying around about her. Some of the stories, the entire town thought she was a witch. Other stories, she was like the woman of loose morals who lived in the town. Other stories, she was a widow. Some stories, she was like the ever-suffering wife of a drunkard type of thing. But in all of them, it's a stormy night. She's giving birth, and there are other women in the room. Some are supposed to be her friends. Some is the midwife. It depends on who's telling the story. And Mother Leeds is, you know, super tired, 12 kids. Here comes a 13th mouth to feed. And in exasperation, she says, just like cries out, let this one be a devil. Sometimes the story is, may the devil take this one. So it switches up a little bit. And the baby comes out like they do, and it's all pink and perfect and squawking like they do. And it suddenly then begins to change. And it changes from a normal baby to a type of devil creature with hooves and a goat's head, or sometimes a horse's head more frequently. It's still bipedal. It's kind of shaped on the bottom end like a kangaroo. It has bat wings and a forked tail and claws and, you know, just this hideous thing. And it shrieks and either flaps up onto the windowsill or it flies up the chimney. Some of the stories will also say that it killed the midwife before it jetted. Some of them don't, but it's said that it was seen circling the village a few times before then flying off into the pines. So that's supposed to be the Jersey Devil. Since then, there have been hundreds of sightings of the Jersey Devil all throughout South Jersey, up into, I think, Trenton was the furthest north it's ever been said to be spotted, over into Philadelphia. And as late as the 70s was like an official in the, I think the Courier Post, it was cited in Camden where a woman beat it with a stick.
And these aren't just, something that I think is really important to point out. These aren't just like, Zeke Bubba from the backwoods.
No, not at all.
Drunk and rum. Like Napoleon Bonaparte III, I think, wrote an account. Of running into the Jersey Devil, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
It was his brother, Joseph.
Oh, his brother did it?
Joseph, that's right, yeah.
Joe Napoleon wrote it.
Joey Napoleon,
Joey
you know.
Napoleon, you know, from France.
Joey Bag of Donuts.
So it's always been this creature or forest spirit or what have you that lurks in the Pine Barrens. And now, for the people who don't know, the Pine Barrens is really big. It's not, I mean, whenever you hear about a forest, it's usually not like a couple of trees and that's it anyway. But like the Pine Barrens is particularly large. It spreads across 7 counties in New Jersey. There's largely rural, largely undisturbed. And back in the 70s, Congress passed legislation to protect 1.1 million acres of it, which was actually the first national reserve to be instated. It's called the Pinelands National Reserve. So it's super big. And way back before white people came here, the Lenape tribes called it, and I'm going to massacre this pronunciation because I don't speak Lenape, Popusing? I don't know. It means place of the dragon. Yeah. Of course. And then there were Swedish explorers who named it Drakekill, which Drake is the word for dragon.
Right.
And then kill means arm of the sea, like a river or a stream in right. Dutch. So it's the river of the dragon. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that that went on. And then this lead story comes along. And now there's this Jersey Devil story. And the way I always looked at it, because growing up, I've, you know, been just piled under stories of stuff like this. Like, we would just go out into the woods, like me and my brothers, and it was instantly the thing that we talked about when we were out there. And like, every kid has a story about seeing the Jersey Devil out while they're canoeing in Batstow or swimming at Lake Atzion or what have you. So there's a lot of different versions of the story, but they all kind of center around the same bits and pieces. You know, it all has their own little core truths to it. But I always, it always struck me that the Jersey Devil was never physically threatening towards anyone. It was always more of like a, almost mischievous, but like a darker mischief. Like, hey, I'm going to appear and scare the pants out of these people who aren't getting out of my forest. And when I was like writing up some notes for tonight, earlier today, the skinwalkers kept popping up into my head, which you recently discussed in your shapeshifting episodes. And it made me think of the skinwalkers because they're the same way. They're super scary, like undeniably frightening, but never actually physically harming anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. When you mentioned the midwife being killed, I'm like, oh, that's the first time I've ever heard of the Jersey Devil actually killing anything other than maybe livestock, you know?
Right, right. Like, usually it's like, oh, we saw the Jersey Devil and now there's a pile of dead chickens. He did it!
Right.
And the midwife being killed, it's not in all of the stories. It's only in a few of them. And it's surprisingly not in the one where everybody says she's a witch either.
Yeah. There's many different versions. There are a lot of different versions of the story. So
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's you know, that's how folklore works. Isn't
right. Right.
Lots of different versions.
Right. Most of them, the midwife like screams and faints and, you know, lives to tell the tale. And mother leads dies in childbirth. Like, that's the normal run of the mill Jersey Devil origin story. Yeah, it's Chris, when he got into Hearn, had made the comment to me comparing it to the Jersey Devil, and the wheels started spinning in my head, and it just kept going. Like, we don't necessarily have a whole lot of that fleshed out because this is still such a new thing for us, but it's definitely a current that we're being led down.
Yeah, and you've drawn such interesting connections and parallels. Like, one of the things you pointed out to me when you first were telling me about this was the idea that, you know, Mother Leeds had 12 children.
Right.
This would be the 13th, and you've got a traditional coven right there. You know, that's
– right.
It's just so fascinating that you were – you know, what made you, you know, turn to – I mean, obviously the story of Hearn led you to the Jersey Devil, but what made you go, hey, I want to, you know, draw upon the folklore for the practice? What kind of put you in that mindset?
It was the desire to have something local. You know, I always had problems identifying with deities from other cultures and other times. They're great. They're there, but they're not relevant to me right now and where I live.
There's no connection.
There's no connection there.
Yeah.
So this was something that offered me a connection. Even though the story is so limited, there are some elements that begin to help put context to, you know, our practice, like you were saying about the coven thing. So that pretty much indicates to us that we will never have more than 12 members because the Jersey Devil will always be our 13th member.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Another element of the story is that Mother Leeds is the Witch Queen to us. Mm-hmm. She's our primary ancestor in a sense, which then and because the Jersey Devil dwells in the forest and we have a bit of an animist tradition going on where we revere the genus Loki, which are the local spirits of the land, the Jersey Devil is kind of our primary genus Loki, which then creates this weird dynamic that the the primary ancestor gave birth to the primary land spirit. Mm. And if the primary ancestor, we view her as a mother figure, then that means the Jersey Devil is our brother.
Mm-hmm.
So like it really sets up this weird dynamic that we're beginning to recognize as we work more and more, adding elements, taking elements away, recognizing things that were there the whole time, but we never really acknowledged, stuff like that.
And it's also... and I'm not sure how many people actually experience this type of thing, but given the way that I was raised, you know, I didn't have a very close family. I don't have any connection to my ancestors, but I also do not have any connection to my heritage. Several different things like American mutt, you know, I'm Russian, but I wasn't raised in any type of Russian culture other than the occasional... borscht or what have you, or someday when someone decides to get a little too hooched up on vodka. But the one side of my family is Cajun, but I know how to make etouffee. That's about it. So there's no hardcore deep-seated connection to any part of my heritage. And I always had difficulty connecting to a pantheon in the same way because none of them were mine. Despite the fact that my name is Tara Maguire, I'm not even remotely Irish. That's just a happenstance that my name happens to sound very Irish. Maguire is my former husband's name that I kept.
Ah, okay.
My maiden name is horrible. So there's no connection to that type of thing. And with ancestor work, I love ancestor work, but I have a lot of difficulty with it because by and large, the family members that I don't speak to, like the rest of them, it's still a complicated as hell relationship. And I don't necessarily want to call on them in my magical workings. You know, I feel very uncomfortable getting my grandmother who drank too much Rolling Rock involved when I want to do some type of Dark Moon rite.
right.
And like beyond my grandmother, I don't know any farther back. Like I don't even know my family history. So this creation of such and aligning ourselves with kind of like a poetic look at the ancestors, like, okay, well, the common ancestor is Mother Leeds. She is our witch queen. You know, she is a primary ancestor for everyone, like that type of thing. That helped me so much with coming to terms with all of these different things. Like I've never been Wiccan. I never followed any of those pantheons that I like Egyptian mythology, but I wasn't following any of that. I never really got heavily into any of the Germanic ones or any of that stuff. But this is like, it's hard to put into words because it sounds kind of corny when you first take a glance at it, like, oh, the Jersey Devil and blah, blah, blah. It's not so much that it's about the Jersey Devil. It's that it's regional. You're connecting with the land that you live on. And at the same time that Chris was starting to get more into like Hearn and such and Jersey Devil and making those connections, at the same time that was happening, I was beginning to garden, which I had never done before. And I got heavily into it to the point I've been accused of being obsessed. and I've been getting very into... you know, the stewardship of my tiny little piece of land. I mean, I don't own it, but it's mine. And taking care of the things that I've put into the ground that are now growing under my steam. And I had my hands in the dirt constantly. And I was watching the earth around me, like what was going on with the animals in our neighborhood, because we're suburban, but we're like rural suburban. So we'll still see things like a heron. And we have this family of turkey buzzards that live around here. It's this quorum of turkey buzzards. And like, you know, like a little more rural than most suburban. We have foxes and we have big deer and stuff like that. So I was seeing all of them and learning what those signs meant of what they were doing. And then I was telling Chris about it at the same time. Like we would go out and I would say to him, look at the leaves at what they're doing. And it would be like when the leaves turn around and that means that rain's coming, And I I would tell him things like that, or I would tell him about the murder of crows that roost near our apartment building that I keep trying to make my friend. And then we went to the I brought him to the Pine Barrens for a few times, and we've gone on pretty deep hikes into there and showing him different things there. So it was all kind of swirling together and turning into this cohesive thing that we're still very much trying to figure out. But it's like, it's a path that's being walked.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. I mean, you mentioned like the idea, like, oh, it sounds hokey because it's this, you know, the Jersey Devil, and, you know, oh, that's just an old folktale. But what I think is so fascinating about that is that it creates this really rich, deep, resonant, not just practice, but kind of just an entire, I don't even want to go with mythology, but this entire sort of culture that you can tap into. You know, you talked about not having the sort of actual, you know, ethnic heritage or bloodline heritage that you wanted to connect to, but you do have all of the family stories of Mother Leeds. Those, you obviously know those really, really well. Mm-hmm. Those are your family stories now, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
And I find it, you know, a lot of times I think what's really interesting, so one of the things I think is I've seen happen with Wicca and witchcraft over the past couple of decades, you know, there was this tendency at one point to sort of talk about the sort of universality of these religions, that they, you know, one horned god was the same as all horned gods, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you guys are doing is tapping into a certain spirit that has been emerging that I'm not going to play it close to the vest. I really like, which is to say, like, you know, your group isn't going to get bigger than 12 people. And so it's going to remain really localized and really connected to that one place. But that doesn't mean other places can't find their own version of that and work with it. And, but it's always going to be local and particular.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the way that we've been writing the tradition, even though it seems silly to call it a tradition at this point, but the way that we've been writing it is that you can take what we're doing and insert it into your region. So someone in the Sorry, I'm tapping the desk and it's making sounds on the microphone. I flail when I talk. You can take what we're writing, and if you live in like the Pacific Northwest, or you live in the South, or in I don't know, New Hampshire, wherever, and you can put it into your particular region and make your connection with that land, but still do the things we're doing. Mm-hmm. Like, we're just creating our own story of it. But the tradition we're writing in and of itself, it doesn't require the Jersey Devil to be a part of it. Like, it doesn't require Mother Leeds. That's just our part of it in our part of the country. And we've been very much into the idea of keeping that idea, like, whole, so that it doesn't become somebody in Indiana trying to make their own flawed and faulty connection to the Jersey Devil because they've never heard of it before. But they've heard of it now. So now they have to like plug into that socket. That's so difficult to do. And it's exactly what we've been trying to get away from.
Yeah. It's where the forms, like you've got, you can use the forms, but you can, you know, change out the actual individual materials. I love that. I'm so fascinated.
I think it comes from our chaos magic backgrounds. We're like, shift the paradigm. All right, let's do this.
I mean, some of the other things that we do is, you know, we have a stang, and that stang was retrieved from the Pine Barrens. So we have, you know, a stang that has that is a part of the Pine Barrens itself. The ritual wine that we use, New Jersey has a very wonderful wine industry. So any wine that we use is always New Jersey wine. So we're drinking wine that was grown from the land.
Right. It almost has that blood of the land feel to it. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's the blood of the land. Yeah. And we do like a type of hoozle thing, and we will use bread that's baked here. So that carries it as well. Every once in a while, we'll buy flowers for different things. And I would prefer to use stuff out of my garden to do that. But most of the things I grow in my garden that have flowers, we can't really bring into the apartment. Because if the cats eat them, they will get very, very sick or die. Everything that I grow that flowers is very baneful. So they don't come in that manner. But like, we're not coming in with I don't know, crazy orchids that were grown in South Africa and shipped here, you know, on icicles to be sold. But I mean, that being said, if somebody wanted to get into the regional animism to their area, they need to look a little bit deeper than what's growing in their front lawn. Like, just in the Pine Barrens alone, it's known for its orchids. It's known for its carnivorous plants. So it's not just daffodils and dandelions type of thing. Like, your region, if you go deeper into it, you find all these layers to it. Mm-hmm. That you just never even knew. And I started discovering that type of thing with gardening and realizing that weeds were plants that just people could be annoyed by because they were invasive. But a lot of them actually had very interesting spirits to them. Mm-hmm. And most of the time are actually very like witchy herbs. Like mugwort's a weed. My God, is mugwort a weed? Wormwood is a weed. Like, all of them are classified as invasive. I have to grow a lot of this stuff in pots because the land that I'm growing in isn't ours, and I don't want to grow anything in it that could possibly take over the front lawn if left to run amok.
I think anybody who's ever grown mint will probably identify very strongly with that.
But a lot of them are like that, and they're indigenous to this area. So someone who wants to get deeper into their land but thinks that their land is kind of boring, they just need to do a little bit of research and see actually what's there. It's always interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you guys have just, you've built such a, I mean, it's just such this localized particular practice, and I can't wait to see what comes next for you guys there. What are your next steps? What are you seeing kind of down the road?
We've been doing a lot of writing. We're still fleshing out parts of things, and unfortunately, I was like, I want to write this thing. And then I wrote like three parts of it and then kind of petered out. but we've started just doing almost personal work. I've started making different tools. Chris has started doing different types of research and writing things. So it's actually falling in line with the lore that I've partially written for the year, where this is the time of the year where you journey inward. Because it's cold out and no one wants to go outside and do anything. And the land is asleep and it's dreaming. So now is the time for introspection. But now is also the time to keep your hands busy, to keep away the despair of winter. So we're doing a lot of just internal work with that type of thing.
Yeah. Very cool.
And the lore she's referring to kind of grew out of abandoning and just completely removing any element of the Wheel of the Year.
Yeah.
So we don't have the eight Sabbat kind of model, that you often find in Wicca and other, forms of, modern witchcraft. We do full moons and dark moons, and we write, our full moons all have their own unique names. Mm-hmm. And then there's lore that accompanies those names. And that's what she's referring to. So like we have like a wheel, but it's not like the eight Sabbat Wheel of the Year by any means. The only two, I think, Sabbat type things that we do incorporate into our practice is Walpurgis Nacht, or, you know, a lot of people call Beltane or May Day. But we like Walpurgis Nacht. We like the name Walpurgis Nacht. So, and Halloween. You know, so we even use the regional name for that day.
Specifically Halloween.
And the practices and rituals that correspond with those days haven't been written yet, but ideas are in the making to make them very more
Sabbat-like.
You know, ecstatic dancing, drumming, things like that.
Man in black.
And our full moon rituals, the full moon and the dark moon rituals are two different types of rituals altogether. Like, the ritual format completely shifts between the two different events.
Which is so awesome.
Because you don't want stuck in a rut.
I'm not big into ritual anyway, so I drag my feet and I don't want to do this. And then, I mean, we were doing the same ritual for each one, and then we shifted it and just completely rewrote Dark Moon. And it stirs it up. Like, you don't get stuck in, like, a now is the time when we do this, like, every 2 weeks, because that can get kind of boring and stagnant and mundane, and it just becomes going through the motions. But now, each time we do ritual, it's Dark Moon specifically, it's like its own little journey work. And that's nice, because that's one of my favorite parts of just witchery in general, is journey work and trance work and hedge crossing and things like that. I've always been rather talented at trancing out. I don't tend to need a whole lot of bells and whistles to do it, even though I like to use them sometimes. But I've always found the best way of getting to the answer of a question is to go on a journey for it. And that's been helping me a lot, actually, with the writing of all of this, too. Like, when we get stuck about where to go to next, and or if we can't agree on something, because that totally happens all the time. just because we're two very different people from very different backgrounds, we will declare, okay, well let's ask the ancestors.
Well, really, it's because you're wrong and I'm right. Yeah, that's really how it works out.
Yeah. And there's been throwdowns, too, where I've just been like, all right, convince me. If you can convince me, I'll say yeah.
But it's if you can summon the Dark Lord right now.
Do it, bro. Come at me.
do you even incant, bro? So, okay. Well, yeah. And so one thing that, Chris, I know that you do art and sculpture and things like that, and some of the things that you've done have been making the rounds on a lot of pagan sites. I think Azure Green has recently picked up one of your sculptures, or both of your sculptures, right? Yeah,
Sacred Source,
yes. Has picked up your Witch Lord and which was it, Witch Queen, or is it?
It's yeah. Is there, it's Witch Queen.
Witch Queen. Okay. So the Witch Lord and the Witch Queen statues. Which are awesome statues. If people haven't seen them, they really need to see them.
Thank you very much.
Amazingly detailed. Yeah, the Witch Lord in particular is one of those ones that I know people are like, yeah, that's really detailed.
His little goatee
tail. That's awesome. It's so cool looking.
Goatee tail.
Yes. But so I'm curious, you know, you've done those statues. Those are really beautiful statues. Do you think there will be a Jersey Devil and a Mother Leeds statuary set, you know, in the works eventually?
Oh,
I would say yes. I would definitely say yes. Definitely on the Jersey Devil. And I was like, not until you said it. I was like, yeah, I should do Mother Leeds. What the hell's wrong with me? You know,
yeah.
But that's how it was with the Witch Lord. When I sculpted the Witch Lord, people were like, so what's the goddess? Like, they were saying, what's the goddess going to look like?
Where's the goddess?
And I was like, what do you mean? And then I'm like, well, I guess I better.
Oh, hell, what have I done?
Well, cool. Well, yeah, if you do wind up making this, I definitely want to see those and point people at them and say, look how awesome these are. You do really good work.
Oh, thank you very much.
So, is there anything else that you want to say about that before I don't want to abandon that topic or anything like that, because it's such a cool topic, but I also don't want to, you know, eat up all of our, every last second that we have with that. So is there anything else that you want to share about that tradition or that work that you've been doing?
Not really. I mean, it's going to be an initiatory tradition, and that just happens by default because, you know, we want to be able to try our best to keep what we're doing to ourselves.
Sure.
And
if you've only got 12 spots.
Yeah. You know? And because some people may want some kind of a curriculum, I think then there might be a need for a degree system, which I really hate to just go and do that because that's just been done so many times. But it looks like something along those lines of a curriculum might be a part of, you know, the tradition. So,
and also just so to be clear, like when you say we only have 12 spots, that's just our group at home. The way that we've been looking at it, it's not just there's only going to be 12 Black Tree, because actually we haven't even said the name at all.
No.
I didn't know you had a name. But
yes, we do. It's the Black Tree tradition.
Okay.
And it's not that there's only ever going to be 12 of them ever. It's anybody who joins that, that we approve, joins that and goes through the things that they need to go through, can then go and start, you know, do the hiving off, the popping off like the gremlin out of the Mogwai's back. You know, you put water on it, another one shows up. Anybody who such goes, I know,
disgusting image too.
Anybody who goes through, you know, the path of the initiate can go into that direction, and they can have their own. And like I was saying earlier, like someone in another state could start morphing it into their regional, their bioregional animism. You know, fun and games. So it's not just 12 forever and ever, amen. Or rather, it's not just 12 forever and ever, so mote it be.
I gotcha. But would you, so I'm curious, like, so if the Black Tree tradition, so say somebody, you know, was learned the Black Tree tradition, you know, using the Jersey Devil and all that sort of within the Jersey context, and then they moved to Maine, say, or to, you know, I don't know, Arizona. Would they still be practicing within the Black Tree tradition, or would they be starting their own tradition based on Black Tree principles?
Yes.
Do you think?
Yes.
If it's A or B, it's yes.
Yeah, then the answer is yes.
Because like
spoken like true witches, I love it.
Yep.
Because there we have our own like ritual style. You know, we don't cast circles. We don't call quarters. We have our own. We have a very specific layout to the space. We have multiple altars that get set up. There's just a lot of stuff woven into, you know, the tradition. That is actually very, very separate from the Jersey Devil itself.
Yeah.
So
it's not like at any point within ritual, it's like, and now is the time on Sprockets when we bring in the Jersey Devil. It's not referenced like that. It's right. Part of the cosmology. It's part of the heart, but it's more, that's our connection. I don't know. It's so hard to explain that part. I've never had to verbalize it. it's the connection that we automatically have. We don't invoke him by name. There's little bits of mentions of Mother Leeds in ritual, but not anything huge either. But it's not quite syncretic either. It's strange. So someone could definitely go to Arizona with the same ritual format, the exact same ritual format at that, and just plug it into whatever weird land spirits are in Arizona. I hear they're dolphins there. Dolphin spirits
in Arizona. Yeah.
But
a lot of like the our cosmology for a while was, even though we knew we wanted to incorporate the Jersey Devil and such, a lot of it was still rooted in my statues, you know, the Witch Queen and the Witch Lord statues. So we had that going on, and then the ideas of incorporating the tales of the, you know, the story of the Jersey Devil and the legend of it. And we're just finding how well that just grafts over the Witch Lord and the Witch Queen scenarios and cosmology that we've been working with. So.
Very interesting. Guys, I'm so excited to see where you're going to go with that. It's just such a cool tradition. Such a cool way of approaching things.
Thank you.
Do you have any other sort of new projects or, you know, is there other news from your life as pagan podcasters that you want to share? I know you guys do have been getting more and more involved with events, public events. I've come to know you through Philly's Pagan Pride days. I know you do South Jersey Pagan Pride. You went to Fairy Worlds East this year. You know, are there other projects on your horizons?
There's a possibility that we're going to go to the Witches Sabbath in Ontario this year.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. There's a possibility of doing that, but there's still some things up in the air about that.
As attendees, not as presenters.
Yes. Not as presenters at all. My goodness, no.
That mostly just means that you're hanging out with really fun people. If I'm remembering correctly.
Yes.
So there's that.
Yeah. But there's, I don't know, like, cause Chris just got done a really huge bronze order. So we've been in recuperation mode.
Yeah. I mean, aside from podcasting, and trying to get new sculpture done for Sacred Source, because I really look forward to building up my catalog over there as being a featured artist. Mm-hmm. I started a YouTube channel, you know, as well.
I've been noticing that. I was kind of hoping you'd talk about that. So what's that? What is that entailing?
It's a lot easier than podcasting, that's for sure, because everything is really short, you know, like the average listener time is like 2 to 5 minutes. So, or listener time, listen to me, I'm such a podcaster. viewing time is, you know, around 3 to 5 minutes. So, but that's kind of like, I'm trying to not get too caught up in the details of how it should be, but personal thoughts, you know, stuff about the coven, stuff about just witchcraft in general. It's going to be a place for me to reflect on interviews that I've had and just experiences that I've had that I want to share with people, mm-hmm. things like that. You know, stuff that I can't have in my podcast anymore just because of the format. You know, I don't have moments in the show where I reflect upon the content of the show itself. So the YouTube channel is a good place for me to do that. And it helps, you know, through a social media aspect, it'll bring people to the podcast and vice versa. So, but mm-hmm. that's fun. It's fun. I'm enjoying it. I have a decent setup, so it seems like it's going pretty well, even though I have like 4 videos out at the moment. So
that's very cool. Yeah. It's neat. It's neat to see kind of you making that. I won't call it a leap because it's not like you're leaping away from what you're doing currently. You've been consistently putting on a really, really solid show. So it needs to see you sort of adding on a new layer to that. Mm-hmm. I like that. Cool. And are you guys going to be doing Fairy Worlds again, do you think?
Probably.
Definitely. I would say so. That's always been a good time. And, you know, you might we might see if you can join us.
Yeah.
I'm very interested. It's always a matter of timing for me. It's just one of those things where, like, you know, I work on a semester schedule, so if things fall during a semester, it can always get, you know, cockamamie for me. But if I can, any chance I get to hang out with you guys is always time well spent. So
awesome. we always enjoy seeing you, Corey.
Yeah.
And just like usual, we're involved with South Jersey Pagan Pride, so mm-hmm. we are on the board of trustees now. Is that?
No. I don't know what we're called.
I don't know what we're called. We're on the board, though.
We're on the board.
We're on the board. We're the organizer type helper people.
Yeah, and we're actually starting a new event this year because we do South Jersey Pagan Pride in October, mm-hmm. and then we also have the Yule Bazaar in mm-hmm. December. And that's, it's all the board from South Jersey Pagan Pride running all of this. And now the president of the board, her name is Amy. She decided that she wanted to have an event in like the springtime that is similar to the Yule Bazaar. It has been named by one of the vendors, the spring thing. One of the vendors from Strange Omens called it the spring thing.
Unofficial title, I think,
even though it's not, So we've been just barely beginning the start of having that hashed out. And I mean, they're very small local events, but they're definitely a lot of fun. We've been planning different things to happen in like future Yule Bazaars. Like I want to have a get your photo taken with Krampus thing uh-huh. set up for there. And
I know some people you can talk to about that.
Yes, because one of the Philly Pagan Pride board members, Michelle, is also at South Jersey Pagan Pride. And mm-hmm. she was like, I need to talk to Frau Perkta. And it came up during Krampuslauf. And she was like, not until after tonight. I can't think about anything else.
Fair enough, though.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, the Krampus. Yeah, it was cool. We got to hang out there as well. So
yeah, that was a really good time.
It was.
It was super fun.
I'm very much looking forward to next year, or rather this year.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's going to be a really busy year for you guys. So it is. That's exciting.
I think it's going to be.
It just gets busier and busier, and that's a good thing.
Sometimes.
That's a good thing. Yeah, I agree. I like having, you know, we can rest when we're dead.
I'm really into resting, though. Like, I am a champ at resting, and I like it like that. I get stressed out very easily. I'm very fragile.
That's what being an honored ancestor is all about, though, is hanging out and letting people offer you crap. Like, that's... You know,
bring me bourbon!
You know, shot of bourbon and some coffee.
Yes.
All right, I'll grant you favors.
Yeah. Thank you, Auntie.
Well, guys, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I really appreciate that. I must have joining me down at the crossroads.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you very much, Corey.
Yeah, this is awesome. It was really, really cool. And if people are interested in finding out more about you, I know they can check out the Down at the Crossroads website, which is still, I think it's still infinite-beyond.com.
Correct.
/crossroads, is that what it is now?
I don't remember the exact URL for the podcast itself, but
it's a tab.
Pretty much everything that I'm doing is through infinite-beyond.com. So, and it's easily navigate. You can easily navigate the
there's
website.
There's also there's a page on there about Blacktree that has like who we are and what we do and blah blah blah. What do we believe? That type of thing. So, anybody who might be interested in learning about what exactly we're doing outside of the whole Jersey Devil folklore aspect of it, they could totally just find the Blacktree tab on the infinite-beyond.com website, and they can learn a whole bunch about it.
Yeah,
perfect. Yeah. Well, cool. Well, we'll put that link in the show notes, and then also want to point people in the direction of the Sacred Source as well, so they can see your like really awesome sculpture.
Thank you.
So, yeah. Well, guys, again, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on New World Witchery.
Thank you.
Thank you, Corey. It was great.
You can say your prayers, work your rites, burn your little candles day and night. You can shimmy till dawn to the pounding drums, but you best be ready when the horn one comes, yeah. Sound of a hunting horn, you dance a ring in the gathering storm. If the solstice time gets your panties in a wad, it's just the coming of the horn god. He will call you out, make you sweat, give you a blessing that you'll never forget. So revel in the chase and let your heartbeat run. Blessed are the children of the horned one. Blessed are the children of the horned one. Hey. Hunter who tracks outside of time, guardian lord of ancient rhyme, brother stag in the musky glen, consort of the goddess in her woodland den. We call you forth as we make our way, walking in your power every day. Guide us true in our hunt this night, maybe even later in the great rite. He will call you out, make you sweat, give you a blessing that you'll never forget. So revel in the chase and let your heartbeat run. Blessed are the children of the horned one.
Blessed are the children of the horned one.
Wait to the sound of a hunting horn. If you dance a ring in the gathering storm, so revel in the chase and let your heartbeat run. When the horn one comes, he's gonna call you out, make you sweat, give you a blessing that you'll never forget. So revel in the chase and let your heartbeat run. Blessed are the children of the horned one. Blessed are the children of the horned one. Blessed are the children of the horned one.
That was Hymn to Hearn by S.J. Tucker. Big thanks to our musical contributors and to our guests, Chris and Tara, for being a part of this episode. You can hear a little bit more about the Jersey Devil, actually, in one of our special episodes back from October of 2012. It was an episode entitled American Devils. I'll make sure there's a link to that in the show notes if you're interested.
I really, really enjoyed getting to talk to both Chris and Tara. And sort of really talking about the way that folklore, they're kind of using folklore as a way to approach witchcraft. And I think that's so interesting and so useful, for people trying to find a way to practice locally that's not based on these sort of existing systems that come out of, you know, European, purely European mythology anyway. You know, if you're, particularly if you're in a New World location, and that doesn't necessarily have to be just the United States. It can be, any North America, South America, Australia, a lot of different places. Really any place that sort of people are expatriated from, a homogenous ethnic origin. Any place like that, there's always this challenge of figuring out, well, how do I integrate into my local surroundings? Because witchcraft is such a local phenomenon, it's always rooted to the place that you're practicing in some way, shape, or form. Because you're following seasonal cycles in some ways, or you may be following lunar cycles, or you may be following, you know, what botanical products are available to you. There are cultural practices around you that you have to adapt to as well. So, you know, if you're practicing some kind of witchcraft or some kind of folk magic, it changes based on your location. And folk systems are oftentimes a really good way to approach those problems. There are definitely some pitfalls and some rewards there. The pitfalls being you can wind up in a situation where you're sort of appropriating somebody else's culture. That's never a healthy way to deal with a new culture. You can also wind up, trying to do something local that then becomes something, that people try to expand beyond that local version. You heard Chris and Tara talking about, you know, they've got the Jersey Devil that they're focused on. And, you know, if somebody took their system and applied it to their own locality, they would have to sort of insert their local, local spirit of place, to make that system work. And I would even go a step further than that and say, you know, they probably would really need to, you know, they might be able to use, what Chris and Tara are doing, sort of with their Black Tree, coven idea. That they might be able to build some of the basic practices off of that, some of the ritual forms, but they really would have to understand a cosmology from the ground up that's based on, wherever they're practicing. And it would be very important to do that, I think, to have a really functional system. I could be wrong. You may have different opinions about that. You may be of the opinion that, you know, witchcraft is witchcraft wherever you go, and it is universal. I know Peter Patton talked about the idea of a mythic landscape, so that when you're operating magically, there's this whole sort of world around you that is mythically inhabited and mythically constructed. And so therefore, you know, if you're working with Celtic deities in Nevada, it's something you can do because you're working in mythic time and mythic space, to contact those deities. And I can understand that, but I also am really, really terrible with things like guided meditation and visualization. So for me, it always does come down to, you know, if you can do something that does tap into that sort of genius loci or, local spirit, local energy, for me, that creates this depth and this richness of practice that you can't find anywhere else. It's sort of a bespoke practice, and I dig that. I really do. What Chris and Tara are doing, I think, is really great. It's refreshingly grassroots. They're building up a practice that connects to their local lore, their local land, and their local magical forms. I mean, Tara talked about being a swamp witch. The Pine Barrens kind of have a swamp feel to them. And that's... That's great because they're creating something new, but it taps into something very, very old, which is, you know, kind of what I think New World witchery, not the show, but, you know, the phenomenon of witchcraft in the New World seems to be all about. So I think that's pretty great. All right. That's enough rambling from me. Again, big thanks to them for this interview, and for this discussion. I hope you enjoyed it as well. We'd love your feedback. You can find us at newworldwitchery.com. You can write to us at compassandkey@gmail.com if you like. You can find us on Facebook. We're facebook.com/newworldwitchery. You can find us on Twitter. We're at @NWWitchery on Twitter. We have a Pinterest page called The Old Broom, which we link to in the show notes if you're interested in following us there. Lots of ways to contact us, lots of ways to kind of let us know your opinions and thoughts. Leaving comments on the blog is certainly a welcome way to do that. Emails are also very good because those are probably the most interactive ways that we get to know what you're thinking and talk to you as well. Facebook's pretty good about that, but I don't always get the notices. So sometimes I miss some of those messages for a couple of weeks. But if I see them, I try to respond to them. So, we are planning to be back for at least one more episode this month. Keep an eye on our feed for that. Huge thanks to our Patreon producers, Corvus, Diana Garino, Renee Otters, Raven Darkmoon, Ye Old Magic Shop, Ivory, Sarah, Molly, Catherine, Athena Beth, The Witch's View Podcast, the whole crew there, and Jen Rue of Ruin Hyssop, as well as to all of our Patreon supporters who are making these extra episodes, more episodes possible. You too can get in on the Patreon fun, help support New World Witchery, and get cool stuff like books and t-shirts in the process. Right now we're about $100 away from launching a new additional podcast all about American folklore. If you can help us out through Patreon, we'd certainly appreciate it. If you can't, your emails, your shares, your iTunes reviews, and other forms of support are just as important to us, so please do keep those coming in too. Our opening and closing music is The Pig Ankle Rag by The Joy Drops, and it's used under a Creative Commons license that can be found on SoundCloud. That is it for this time. We will be back again soon, we hope, to share more magical lore and discussion with you. Until then, thanks for listening. Be well.